Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and as we usually do for the last 29 years, on Sunday evenings at this time, we begin the TechNet. What you're about to listen to is TechNet number 1377 of the series that began in September of 1982. So for 29 years, on Sunday evening, guys get together and discuss their favorite subject. Ham radio in general, and there's lots of different kinds of ham radio, 26, 27 different kinds. The CEO of American Radio Relay League brought that to our attention in a lead article about a year or so ago in the magazine. A person signs into the technical net by giving me, I'm sorry to say we don't have Mel anymore, I think it was October 23rd was the last time that we heard from Mel. He sounded very good, but soon after that he passed away, and he was a major contributor to the technical net for the last 5 or 6 years at least, if not longer than that. You may know that there has been an attempt, let me drop, that LIMOC, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, is setting up a website that is attempting to do what Mel did, and that was answering a large number of emails from people just getting into ham radio who have all kinds of questions before they have the ability to get their license and get on the air. So a website is being formed by which people can mail in their question, and a staff is in the process of being formed, which will be giving answers to that website. I think is going to be technicalnet or technet@limoc.org. Also, if you hear disruptive information, if you hear a disruptive signal during the TechNet, please press the reverse button on your radio so you can hear the input and report that signal strength again to interference@limoc.org. It's really going to Len K2IVX, who collects that information. A person signs into the technical net by giving me, for so many years I've said me and Mel and I, me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. We do make a sincere effort to answer questions during the first hour for the people who sign in at the beginning, at least a brief answer. And bear in mind that there is no such thing as a dumb question. The dumb question really represents a larger difference between what the person knows and what he would like to know. So you're not going to be ridiculed because you ask what you think is a dumb question. There's lots of people out there afraid to ask that exact question, and therefore you're doing them a service. So give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or comment. Please do that right now. K2RIW.
W2RIY. Joe. Yes.
Okay, Joe's our first sign-in. Anyone else?
WS2N, Paul with a short space report.
Okay, we got Paul with a space report. You think you're going to have a question later on, or in the beginning, Paul? Go ahead.
I have one question, but if you want to wait, that's fine. If not, put me on the list.
Okay, you've got a question, you're on the list. So far we got Joe and Paul in that order with questions. Anyone else with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KD2PA, Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Hotel November.
Okay, that was an extremely noisy signal, but I think it was Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Hotel November. Want to tell me your name, sir? Okay, why don't you please tell me your name twice, because you said it during a fade. Go ahead.
John.
Did you say your name is John? Go ahead.
Correct.
Okay, I heard correct. Anything you can do to increase that signal strength by the time we get to you, you're the third guy on the list, John. And bear in mind that you might, if you're operating with the handy-talkie, you might have to operate from some other position in the room or some other orientation of the handy-talkie. And you're going to have to find that by experiment. Bear in mind that when you move a handy-talkie around the room so that you get the strongest signal from the repeater, it's not necessarily the best signal position to transmit from, because the transmit frequency and the receive frequency are slightly different. So the best position to transmit from could be a slightly different position. Okay, we got Joe, Paul, and John in that order. One last call. Anyone else? letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
KC2WGB. Two email questions if you can handle them, Dick.
Okay. Yeah, I think you, John, I believe, are one of the volunteers. Bernie is another volunteer of people who are going to be volunteering for answering all of those questions that people mail in. Mail used to get, at times, somewhere between 70 and 300 emails per week from people asking questions. Wow, I don't know how we handled all that, and that went on for years. So I think, John, you have volunteered. Also has Kent, Kent Britton, WA5EJB, who writes the weekly or monthly or bi-monthly article on the subject of antennas for CQ Magazine. And so Kent has also volunteered. One last call. Anyone else with a question or a comment for the net tonight, please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. Joe, looks like we might have a slightly slightly late night tonight. And so take your time, Joe, and give us your question or comment. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Good evening, Dick, and the net, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. My question deals with how to locate a noise source. I don't know if I should tell you a lot about it initially or just a little bit about it initially. I'm having an interference problem with noise coming into my repeater. It seems to be electrical noise in nature. I've located the source of the noise within about 300 feet on an axis type of thing, on a roadway. My question is how to more locally find this noise source more specifically. I don't know, you know, really what else I could do. I don't know if I can use some sort of directional antenna or what I'm going to use. The noise seems to be a component that's measured from, say, at least 30 megahertz on up to about 400, almost 500 megahertz. And what I see is a noise component that sounds like it has either 60 or 120 cycle component on it, as seen on a spectrum analyzer. If you put the analyzer on an extremely narrow scan, the noise appears less than every 10 kilohertz, and coming in on my repeater input about minus 70 dBm as displayed across the input area of the receive port of the duplexer and the receiver. It's becoming quite a problem. It's reducing my range significantly as far as how the repeater goes talking into it. And I'd like to be able to specifically find the noise source to be able to possibly, you know, try to, you know, put it into it, whether it's LIPA or who else is doing this. Any suggestions on something like this, how to, you know, more specifically find that within a few feet, possibly?
The first question I've got there, Joe, is the noise that you're hearing that's affecting your repeater, is it on 2 meters or 440? In either case, a directional antenna, even on 2 meters, a three-element Yagi, even a two-element Yagi, can give you a lot of direction finding. One of the things you've got to worry about, if the source of noise was a point source, then direction finding works very well. Inverse square log works very well. In other words, even though the signal might be strong enough to saturate whatever you're using as a detector, by putting a step attenuator in front of it, as you walk closer and closer to it, the signal gets stronger and stronger, and you pin it down that way. That's if it's a point source. The worst case source of noise is one where some little black box somewhere is going haywire, making noise, and the major method by which the noise is being transmitted to the outside air is by way of the 110-volt wiring. And now if the noise source is being spread by the 110-volt wiring, and therefore the power wiring to that house, and maybe even the high voltage or wiring down the block, now you've got what looks like a distributed source of noise. And that's a very tough one to pin down. So, which of those techniques have you used so far, Joe? A step attenuator, and as you get closer, you plug in more and more dBs, or direction finding? What have you used so far, Joe? W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, Dick, I believe I told you the frequency span of what I measured on the analyzer, where I see the peak amount of noise. It starts at about 30 megahertz and works its way up in intensity, and it peaks out at say 100 megahertz and it's fairly constant in level up to at least 450 megahertz. So it's through 2 meters, 220, and 440. I used to have a 220 beam, but unfortunately I gave that away to somebody, so I don't have a direction finding antenna anymore.
WHCDL, I got a couple of questions, Dick.
Yeah, I bet you've done quite a bit of fox hunting along these lines, Andy, so tell us what you've done. You got it, Andy.
Yeah, good evening. Just a couple of questions to Joe, just to narrow down where this may be coming from. The question just came to mind is, number one, how long has this noise problem been going on, or did this just start? And maybe you could describe the type of noise that it is. In other words, is it a line noise condition? Is it a static kind of noise? Is it a white noise? Because there's different, as Dick knows, there's different types of noises. One of the reasons why I jumped in is because I've noticed tower lighting, the new lights that are being installed on towers, and I don't know where your repeater is located. It might be on a tower with a red tower light. And it turns out that every time the light goes on at night, when it blinks on and off, it's creating noise. And there are some repeaters that I know this is happening to. So that's just a question that came to mind. And maybe there's a light installation on a tower that just occurred, and maybe the tower light is on all the time creating this noise. So these are just some possibilities. It just popped into my head regarding what kind of noise it is, when did this problem start, and do you have any lights on your tower where the repeater is?
Andy, Joe did say that it's got a 60-cycle component. And when there's a 60-cycle component, which might be amplitude-modulated when you look at it on an oscilloscope, the detected receiver output on an oscilloscope, particularly on the IF strip connected to the oscilloscope. Another thing worth considering is that if you synchronize the oscilloscope to 60-cycle line going into the oscilloscope as opposed to synchronizing it on the signal, and then you tune the receiver from the low end, where I think you said you hear it at 30 megs, and then the high end toward 450 megs, the 60-cycle envelope of noise that you see on the oscilloscope, does that noise keep the same position on the screen as you change frequency? In other words, if, for instance, there's a really ratty oscillator of some kind that is sweeping from 30 megs to 500 megs, and it's doing it with the 60-cycle power, then when the scope is externally synchronized to 60 hertz, as you tune the receiver across that frequency range, you'll see the envelope, the peak of the envelope, move across the screen, if you know what I mean. So these are some of the clues. In other words, is the noise with the 60-cycle component AM modulated, FM modulated? These will all give you some clues. Back to you, Joe, for the HURYY, HURYW in the TechNet.
I'm not sure what that background noise was. Somebody's going to miss my radio downstairs. Okay, what I use for an instrument to be able to detect this noise, to listen to it as well as look at it, is my IFR 1500 service monitor. Andy knows exactly what that is capable of doing. It has two tone oscillators inside, and it's capable of putting it into a configuration where you can look at the modulation waveform and use one of the generators to beat the frequency of what's coming in with one of your internal generators. I can get the pattern to stop or freeze at 40 hertz, 60 hertz, and 120. And it seems to really look like at 120 hertz, you're looking at the same frequency. And if I turn up the volume on the unit, this is, of course, the unit actually demodulating AM, not FM, because it comes in better that way, receive-wise. If I flip on the internal tone switch, wireless on 120 hertz, I seem to get an audio match. It seems like actually the component of the noise, I thought it was 60 hertz, I should mention this. It looks like it's actually more than 120 hertz. It's distributed in frequency of less than every 10 kilohertz per division on the analyzer. And if I go narrower, it seems to be even narrower, but it's hard to get you up, hard to come up in spikes, but at a minimum, that's what I'm looking at right there. So that's something about what I'm visually seeing. And as it, when I get to a particular street intersection where this noise is located, about 300 feet from the street in any direction, the noise will disappear in amplitude by a factor of 30 to 40 decibels. And if I go back to the intersection, it comes back up again. Let me get the repeater reset. So that's what I'm looking at, is a peak envelope level distributed across the peak signal level of about minus 70 dBm with the analyzer measured even at, let's say, 1 megabit division, 100 kilohertz division, or 10 kilohertz division. 10 kilohertz seems to go down a little bit in amplitude from what I visually see, but that may be due to the instrument's internal bandwidth setting. But that's basically what I'm looking at. But I don't notice it into the HF band. I'm looking at it at 5 or 10 megahertz. And I don't look, see it really past 450 to 500 megahertz. And I'm using a quarter wave VHF antenna to look at this thing, which is fairly, you know, wide open as far as its resonance. But that's what I'm looking, that's what I'm using for an observed type of instrument to observe what I'm looking at there. So I'm not sure. I initially went up on the roof of the building where my repeater's located and went around with a receiver attuned to my input frequency. And I could hear it someplace on top of the building with the receiver tuned to AM. But nothing, of course, was localized that way. You know, you actually found this, actually found it by dumb accident, by setting up the analyzer in the car and driving within a radius of the building of about maybe a quarter mile to a half a mile. And as I got near the source, this is where I found it. It's about maybe 1,500 feet, linear feet, away from my building. So my antenna on top of the building is pretty much looking directly at this source.
Now, if I understand you correctly, Joe, when you go to a particular intersection where it's loudest and then you drive in any direction from there, it gets weaker. At that particular intersection, you make it sound like there isn't a building there, that this is just two streets coming together and a lot of lighter and other kinds of wiring at that street. And so, again, I'm starting to speculate that the wiring is the antenna for it, but is it really a box of electronics that's on that particular utility pole? So am I correct in assuming that there's an intersection where it's the loudest, but there isn't necessarily a building there that contains a chunk of electronics? Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
There is a building there. On the particular street that goes north and south, there's a set of apartment buildings on the east side, on the north side and the south side. And I've thought of that, and I've also it also looks like there's wires coming from the pole going down the side of the pole, fairly high, heavy ones, which seem to look like possibly power wires that are feeding possibly underground voltage as far as power. Because I was told that sometimes these buildings have a transformer volt of their own and distribute the power from light underground through a transformer volt buried somewhere or located somewhere on the property or someplace like that. I haven't been able to physically see where that is. All I can tell you is as they drive from the intersection, away from the intersection, a distance of 300 feet or more, the noise diminishes rather rapidly. So I think you're right. The power lines are distributing the noise to a certain point, but I'd like to be able to more precisely find out the source of the noise if I possibly can, so I can call up Life and say, hey, it's your equipment, this is what you're doing to me, and see if they can take it from there. Because I don't know right now specifically if it's them that's causing the problem or somebody else.
Dick, I have to go, but I just want to add one more thing that I use to track down noise.
Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, Joe, if you want to construct a simple loop antenna, I've used this many times to track down noise, even to a bad street light, many years ago when I lived in Merritt. And I used to use this loop when we had the 10-meter transmitter hunts. It's simply... About a 1 foot diameter of copper wire or copper tubing, quarter inch or eighth inch copper tubing, whichever you want to use, with a little gamma match on the bottom of it to match to the coax connector. And what I have attached to that is a broadband RF detector. It's just very simply a little audio amplifier with a diode hanging off the loop, going into the volume pot, and later on I added a broadband preamp, which gave some gain. The antenna itself is tuned The rest of it is all board banded. And because it's just an AM detector, very simple, it worked quite well. And since it's a loop antenna, I can swing it around and see where the null is or where the peak is, and it would give me a sort of a direction, and it worked. I even use it to track down the noise coming from my spark plug wires in my car, and I can vary the sensitivity of it. There are articles in QST on how to build this. It's a very simple thing, and it works quite well. You don't have to use any fancy beams or things like that. Since it's all self-contained, it's got headphones, so you just wear the headphones and just walk around. And you'll hear, when you get to a power line or a pole, you can just get it near the pole, and if the noise is loud enough, you'll hear it. So that's an idea for you. Okay?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You didn't make it clear, Andy, but I'm guessing that loop was also used for direction finding. The loop is a bidirectional. In other words, when the signal is in the plane of the loop is held vertical, you get the maximum signal. And when the signal is broadside to the loop, the signal goes into a null. You've got a null on the north side and the south side of the loop, so to speak, when the loop is east and west, when the plane of it is east and west. And by moving your body around, you eventually figure out which is the real and which is the phony direction. And so, were you using direction finding with that loop, Andy? And there's a way of making it unidirectional instead of bidirectional. It doesn't sound like you did that. Over to you, Andy.
Yeah, I could add a sense antenna to it to make it more unidirectional, but I did mention I use it on transmitter hunting. It's a direction finder that I use on 10 meters. But since it's broadbanded, and you're exactly right, the null is through the loop, so that the peak is off the side, and the null is broadsided to it, just like you described. But the beauty of it is it's all self-contained. It's battery operated. It's got little headphones, and you just walk around with it. And as you point in different directions, I can pinpoint the source or see the direction the noise is coming from. Then as I walk closer, the noise gets either louder or weaker. And it's worked quite well. I don't want to time it out again. Back to you.
Andy, if Joe's problem persists for some significant amount of time from now, would you be willing to loan that loop assembly of yours to Joe? W-H-U-C-D-L, K-2-R-I-W.
Yeah. Yes. I want you to know what kind of noise this is. Even though it sounds almost like line noise, but is there a tower light? And how long has this noise been going on for? That could be a clue. This just start. Because maybe you noticed something that you didn't notice before. We had a discussion once, Dick, regarding the fluorescent lights in my lab. When I turn my fluorescent lights on, it's creating noise all over the place with the switching power supplies. And I got to change that out. It's really, really bad. So it could be a fluorescent light fixture, even in the building. Could be, all these possibilities. Back to you, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, Joe, we would like to know when it started. With direction finding, you may pin down the source a little bit better. If there was a way you could get access to that multi-floor apartment building with this detector and walk up and down the various floors of the building, when you get in front of the apartment that's doing it, if that's what it was, in theory you're going to hear a louder noise. So these are some clues. So how long ago did it start, Joe, and do you know of any changes that occurred at around that time, like new sets of lighting, street lighting put in? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
It's been going on for actually several months now. I just had enough time this time to actually get annoyed about it because what would happen is I'd stand out in front of my house. I'm like 8-9 miles away from my repeater, and I could not key the repeater up with 4-watt HT outside. And I'm running a sophisticated repeater, free amp, full length stage mirrors, and so forth. Where I used to be able to talk to the repeater almost full quiet in many spots with less than a half a watt. So something significantly changed in my input. Sure enough, when I went up to the spectrum analyzer, in the IRHOR 1500, that's what it showed me on the input of the receiver, coming, feeding the receiver with the preamp and everything, and my filtering up there, that I got this about negative 70 dBm signal that's on my input at the repeater's site location. And I'm sure it would take out an HC at many miles away, wouldn't it? But I get the same kind of indication distributed no matter what analyzer dispersion setting I go on, from 1 meg down to 10 kilohertz, it seems to be similar in level with a peak of about 65, 70 dBm into a quarter wave antenna at this particular intersection location. So if it's coming from the building, I would need probably to do something where I can walk around with something portable that's very, very insensitive that will probably help me where I get on top of the noise. Noise is going to, kick up very, very strongly as far as giving an indication as a particular point source location of what this where it's possibly going to be coming from. And I don't know what else to really say about the thing. Do you need any other information?
Yeah, I think you've answered all the questions. And by way of your quarter wave width that you've been using up till now, you can sort of use that for inverse square law. In other words, as you get closer, it gets louder. But when you've got a distributed source like it's beginning to sound like you've got, I think the next step is a direction-finding antenna. The loop antenna that Andy is offering is one solution, because a 450 antenna, a three-element 450 Yagi would be quite compact. I'd be tempted to build, borrow, or steal, or modify one of those and walk around with it. It'd be nice to know, do you get a stronger signal horizontally polarized versus vertically polarized? And with that three-element Yagi, you can do some beautiful direction finding. So I'm beginning to think the next step is a portable direction finding antenna. I am guessing that your IFR 1500, if I know you, it might have a battery by which, for at least an hour's worth, you can probably run it portable on its battery, although it's kind of heavy to carry around. Is that true, Joe? And if that's too heavy to carry, then Andy's loop antenna thing sounds like it's a lot lighter. W2RYY, K2RYW.
A6DPZ with a comment.
JXM.
Okay, Al, and then JXM in that order. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, one of the Helix, 450 Helix is not big, it's very directional. It uses a tracking antenna. He can pretty much nail down what he wants to find.
What I don't like about the Helix is that with a Helix you can't tell horizontal versus vertical polarization. I would much rather see him using a three-element Yagi. Mr. JXM, go ahead with your comment.
Can I have a comment, Dick?
Go ahead, Hal. What's the advantage of a Helix where you can't tell polarization versus a Yagi where you can get direction finding and polarization? Go ahead, Hal.
Having an interference problem, but you're not as concerned about polarization as locating the source of the interference. That's my comment.
Understand. But polarization is one more clue. JXM, go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. KB2JXM, Gary over here. I have a question about antennas, if we're going to go that way.
Okay. As long as you're on the same subject, which is the interference that Joe's trying to pin down, and if you've got a question about antennas for pinning down direction finding of interference, go right ahead, Gary.
No, this is just slightly off the subject.
Okay, your name is on the list. There's a few people ahead of you. Okay, so Joe, it looks to me like I know that the 1500 is kind of a bulky thing to carry around, even if it's got a battery, so that's kind of difficult to walk into an apartment building with that, in which case Andy's loop antenna with a small little amplifier and headphones might be a lot easier. W2RYY, K2RYW.
K2MU, late check-in.
WGB with a question on the subject.
MU, you're on the list. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I'd like to know if Joe has tried an AM radio at the point where he found the signal the strongest. He may be able to trace it down with a little hand pocket transistor radio. You can do a lot of things with that. I was just wondering if the noise is available on that.
Yeah, he did say that the signal starts at 30 megacycles. And so is there going to be enough signal there in between channels of an AM radio? I'm afraid he might not have enough noise down there, but the nice thing about the AM radio with its loop stick is, yes, that is a directional antenna. If there was enough noise down there that he could hear it in between channels. W2RYY, K2RYW.
As far as what I can see coming in on the antenna at frequency below 1 megahertz, it pretty much looked like it disappeared. I was seeing other line noise. And to answer Andy's question, the type of noise I was looking at was not line noise as far as what I'm used to seeing. That seems to be very narrow in duration if you look at it on a spectrum analysis where the signal you're looking at is extremely narrow in width. The width of what I was looking at seemed to be about maybe 5 or 6 kilohertz in width, maybe a little more than that, and it was less than every 10 kilohertz spacing up and down the frequency from 30 megahertz going on up to, like, say, almost 500 megahertz. It rolled off past 500. I have an 800 meg Yagi. I don't know if it'd be, I don't have energy up there to be able to look at something like that way up that high. It seemed to be seen to diminish itself quite a bit, and it also would diminish quite a bit very rapidly as it went below 30 megahertz. There's really nothing I could see, like I said, below 1 megahertz. It pretty much disappeared down there.
Roughly how portable is your 1500, Joe? Is that out of the question to go walking around with it on a battery? In which case, you'd either want to build or borrow Andy's loop plus his little detector. Over to you, Joe.
I purposely took the battery out of that unit. In fact, both units I have, because it makes it rather heavy, a lot heavier than what normally is. You're talking about, say, 40 pounds without the battery, and maybe, you know, 45, 50 pounds with the battery, maybe a little more, depending on the weight of the battery. Since I didn't have measured, but I know it lightened it up quite a bit. It would really stress your arm out and trying to walk around more than about 10, 15 minutes worth of time with that thing. It's not really meant for that kind of operation. It could probably do it, but it would, and the battery also would not support running the thing on an hour worth of time either. They just don't run that long.
One last suggestion along those lines, Joe. A kind of a cart, the kind of a cart that people use for transporting a suitcase, might be a way of wheeling it around. Although now it's an obtrusive looking piece of electronics that's going to scare people, but that is a slight possibility. What do you think, Joe?
Well, that's a possibility too, but I don't really need to look at it. I think I like Andy's idea better. In fact, I may contact him directly about that. The size of that seems to be something I could walk around with. I don't know if it's mounted on a pole or how it's physically constructed, but that seemed like something you could easily walk around on the outside and possibly in some sort of building without looking too terribly scary to people.
It sounds like Andy's got what you need, and hopefully you and Andy can get together and you can borrow that thing from him, and boy, he's done it. Quite a bit of successful bunny hunting with it. The thing has got history. Good luck with that, Joe, and let us know how that project goes. Next person who signed in, supposedly with a simple question, was Paul, WS2N. WS2N, K2RW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, it's just a really iambic keyer type of question. And it has to do with the advertisements. I'll probably call up MFJ. I'm kind of understanding your advertisements. When they advertise these iambic paddles, you know, you could buy it without a keyer, you know, and then hook it up to a radio that has a keyer, or if you have an external keyer, you could hook it up to it. But they advertise that as an iambic paddle. Now, you know, iambic, of course, means, let's say if you squeeze the two together, you're going to get a series of dot dashes, da 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 da, if you squeeze the two together. So, you know, you squeeze together it for a C, and you're going to get da da da, you know. That's really what an iambic is. But they sell these things, you know, without the electronics attached to it. You know, it's really just three wires, a wire for a dot, a wire for a dash, and then you have a shield. You know, to me, it's not really iambic unless you hook it up to an iambic keyer. You know, so it's really a question of definitions. You know, what do they mean by this, Dick? That's what I'm trying to figure out, you know, in other words. Do you call it an iambic paddle even so it doesn't have any electronics attached to it? Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
I'm going to make a guess on this one, Paul, and that is, an iambic keyer could be a device that's got two paddles to it. It's simply got a pair of contacts, one set of contacts. When you press on the list, you get dots and press on the right side, you get dashes or vice versa. So it could be two sets of contacts connected to two paddles and a three-wire cable coming out of it that goes to a kind of a plug that's got a tip, a ring, and a cylinder to it. And now the dots and dashes are being made internally by the electronics that's in your transceiver. I think it's possible to do it that way. And then in your particular case, if you just want to send simple Morse code, there is another jack on the back of your rig where when you're in the CW mode, you simply connect those two wires together of that other jack, and the rig goes on the air and off the air with an ordinary straight key. So I'm guessing an iambic here could be one that might necessarily not have any electronics to it. Let's see if anybody who is smarter than me on this one can give us some hints right now. Give me a call, let us, if you've got information on that subject. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Before I do that, one piece of information.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
You know, I own an MFJ electronic gear paddle. You know, it's a MFJ 422B, you know, Bravo. And, you know, it is a... you know, it's all in one. It's a keyer and a paddle all together, and then that just plugs into my radio. But I'm thinking about another keyer because you know the newer radios have the keys inside. So I'm thinking of another paddle. So that's what it all comes down to. Dick, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out. You know, do they sell these things? Do they already have a Curtis chip in it, which is doing that work of? Automatically switching back and forth, you know. So, just to give you that piece of information, I do have an MFJ. This is just like, you know, I want to see in the future buying another one. You know, since the new radios have the keys in them, I wouldn't need an external key. Back to you, Dick.
Your MFJ iambic here with electronics built into it, and it's got a kind of a double paddle to it, and you press one paddle and you get continuous dashes, you press the other paddle, you get continuous dots, and somewhere you've got a potentiometer which sets the keying speed. I'm guessing that MFJ, complete electronic keyer, has a output connector with two wires. It opens and closes those two wires, and therefore turns the rig on at the right way so that it makes dots and dashes. So I'm guessing it has two wires. Whereas if the keyer electronics is already in your radio, then it needs a kind of a three-prong plug in order to differentiate the paddle side that dots, the paddle side that dashes, and the common, which is ground. So I am guessing you've got at least two different jacks on the back of your rig. One jack that takes a three-wire thing, that would be a bare iambic paddle, or the jack that takes a two-wire thing, which would be your complete electronic gear. Does that seem to make some sense? How many wires are in your MFJ? I'm guessing it only has two wires coming out of there. There's probably a way you could rewire it to have direct access to the paddles if you want to use the electronics in the rig, but I don't think you have to do that. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's two wires coming out of mine, so it feeds in all the rig. It's a Kenwood 440. And which does not have an internal key to it, but the newer rigs, which I'm thinking about eventually, they all seem to come with the electronic key inside the rig. So you know, I would hook up they call it an iambic paddle to the rig, three wires to a new rig, for instance. With the key inside, the tip is a dot, the next one down is a dash, and then the barrel part of it, you know, that's the third wire, the shield, and I would wire that into it that way. But you know, they sell it as an iambic keyer, but I mean, that's my question. To me, it's really iambic. Do all these new rigs have, you know, the keys that are in them, are they iambic? You know, I mean, can you buy a rig and then you find out it's not iambic, you know? That's really the question, Dick. I've checked the internet. I've even gotten on HF and a couple of guys on 40 meters. I haven't gotten an answer yet on this. Back to you, Dick.
I think you have a couple of choices here, Paul. You own a complete MFJ iambic here with its electronics that makes the dots and the dashes, and you've got the dual paddle. You could take its two-wire plug, plug it into the CW portion of your plug on the back of your rig, and now you've got complete automatic dots and dashes. You have the choice, in my opinion, to rewire your MFJ. You could rewire your MFJ so that you have direct access to the paddle contacts independent of the electronics. You could put a slide switch or a toggle switch on your MFJ, which allows you to run in the electronic internal mode for making dots and dashes into a CW key, or you flip the switch the other way and you have direct contact to the paddle on your MFJ, and now let the rig inside do the automatic keying. Now, because of the speeds and the degree of difficulty of setting the speeds and the weighting and user-friendliness, you might desire that the electronics inside of your rig is for some reason more desirable than the electronics that's in your MFJ. Reliability, user-friendliness, whatever. In which case, I think you have the option of rewiring and get direct access to your paddle independent of the electronics on the MFJ. I know you've got that choice, and I know you could handle that rewiring. But let's throw the question out to the group, though, that you weren't able to get on 40 meters an answer. When people talk about an iambic keyer, are they talking about this MFJ with all the electronics built in? Or in some cases, are they just talking about a three-wire paddle where all the electronics is in the rig itself? Anybody got an answer on this? Give me your call letters, K2RIW and the TechNet. Looks like we're not going to get an answer here either, Paul. You checked on 40 meters or 20 meters, didn't get an answer. And this usually well-informed group doesn't seem to have an answer tonight. But as I see it, you've got dual choices. Now, is it possible you like the user-friendliness of your MFJ in its iambic keyer mode better than the iambic keyer electronics that's built into your rig? You could wire it either way, and you could make it so that it goes both ways, if you know what I mean, by flipping your switch that you add to the MFJ. The MFJ, just because you've owned it for a while and maybe the warranty is worn out, that doesn't mean you're not allowed to open up the cover and add switches and modify it. Not to worry, there isn't a scorpion in there with a year's supply of food, if you know what I mean, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW. How about it, Tiger?
Yeah, rewiring, that's no problem. In fact, I've had this box open. You know, they have an internal 9-volt battery in it, and every time that thing quits on you, you know, you got to take the box apart. They don't make it that easy to take apart and then put the new battery in. Well, I gave up with that years ago, back in the 80s, when I first got this thing. And I went through that one or two times, and that was it. I opened that up, and I put an external battery clip, 9-volt battery clip on the outside. So that battery always sits on the outside. Not that it takes a lot to kill it, but if you act on, you know, if you leave it on, you know, for a couple of days, you'll come back to a dead battery. That's what tends to happen. I never got the wall warp for it. I never needed that, you know. But of course, that would have been a good way to go. 9-volt battery, I mean, this thing will last for months and months. Very good, Dick. No, it works good. Let me drop it.
You know, Joe, I've got a suggestion for you. That 9-volt battery problem is a real pain. If you rewire it, you have direct contact to the two paddles into your rig, and your rig is now powered by the 12-volt power supply going to the rig, it'll never again have a 9-volt battery drop out. So that rewiring sounds to me like a very desirable way to go. Over to you, Paul.
Oh, yeah, it is. But, you know, the new rigs that they sell, you know, they say, oh, it all has an electronic keyer in it. But, you know, they don't advertise it as iambic, you know. And, well, I don't know, like 75% of my HF is always on CW, and I like the iambic system. It's really good. Some people don't, but I like it. And if I bought another rig, well, the advertisements on them, you know, you have to call up, and sometimes they might not even know. But you have to call up, or if you're buying a used rig, you know,
try to figure out if these internal rigs are really iambic or not. Would be a nightmare. If you want to look at 5-10 different rigs before you buy one, you know, which one will I buy, you know? So it comes down to that, and, you know, and definition. For instance, MFJ, they advertise it. If you look on, the advertisements for MFJ in page 126 of this month's QSC, they show a picture of these iambic paddles. Well, to me, they're not iambic unless there's electronics hooked up to it. It's kind of like, you know, it can be used in the iambic mode as long as you have an iambic, you know, thing hooked up to it. That's the way I think it is. So, basically answering my own questions. There you go, Dick. Back to you.
All comments. Yeah, I've got one more comment on this one, and then we're going to go over to Hal, and that is, to me, a bug-like keyer is one where you press with your thumb if you're right-handed, and you get continuous dots, I think it is. You press with your index finger, you get a continuous dash for as long as you hold it. If you squeeze, in the case of an iambic keyer, if you squeeze the dot first and then the dash and hold the two paddles together, it'll give you da-da, 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 da-da. And if you press the index finger first and then the thumb second and hold the two paddles together, you get a continuous dotted, 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 dotted. So that's what I think an iambic keyer is. It'll with one paddle make continuous dots, with one paddle make continuous dashes, and squeeze both, you get either da-da, 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 or dotted, dotted, dotted. That's my guess. Hal, you probably got some more knowledge on this. K6DPZ, if that was you, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
Hey, Dick, it sounds as WS when it sounds like this. You know, I'm just squeezing it together for a period, and then, like what you said, the dash, you know, for the C. So, you know, it's 100% right, but this is a question of definition of terms. Back to you, Dick.
Understand. Al, wait for the beeps, and you got it.
Well, it wasn't me, Dick, but from what I know of iambic keyers, if the keyer is iambic, you can put it into a standard key jack and a transceiver or a transmitter, and you'll have an iambic type of paddle, as long as you have a separate keyer that's iambic, with the electronics.
Now, hold on. If you've got his MFJ with the electronics is a two-wire output, but the electronics allows him to make automatic dabs, automatic dashes, or automatic da-da or da-dit. That's one kind of iambic keyer. Is it still an iambic keyer if you've got three wires coming out of it, where you have independent connection to the dot paddle, independent connection of the dash paddle, and all the electronics is in the rig? Is that also an iambic paddle type keyer? Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
On more current rigs, I would say yes, but I would say all of them, depending on the chip they're using inside the rig for the King system.
Understand. Was there another person with a comment on this? Give me your call letters right now.
K2GJE.
K2GJE. I should know. Start with your name and then your comment, sir.
Ed.
You got it, Ed.
I'm using an ICOM. If I plug into the front with a tip ring and body and a paddle, all the electronics are in the rig. If I want to use a straight key, I just have to plug it to the back with an old-fashioned two-wire plug, over.
Does it become iambic, Dick?
Yeah.
It's iambic only if I plug into the front and use a three-wire cable, over.
Okay, that's good to know. There you go, Dick.
Okay, so it's the iambic interconnection between your external paddle and the rig, which has three wires. If it only has two wires, it's either intended for a straight key or a kind of iambic keyer where all the electronics is in the keyer. Does that sound right, Ed? Go ahead.
Yes, it does, Dick. If I wrongly plug into the front, I'll only get dots or dashes. I have to use a paddle if I plug into the front. If I plug into the back with a straight two-wire key, then I'm on the control. Otherwise, the electronics from the front panel take over. K2GJE, back to net.
Yeah, that seems to make a lot of sense, Ed. Out of curiosity, Paul, do your two particular contacts for your rig, is there a connector in front, which maybe is the iambic three-wire paddle, and the contact in the back, which is a conventional straight key connection. Enough about the way it's set up on your rig, and what kind of a rig is that, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, I'm dealing with the Kenwood 440. There's only two wires on this. I'm talking about if I get a new rig, you know, who's it, Ed? He got the ICOM or the Ace, you know, which rig do you buy? I want to make sure, since most of the times I go on CW that they have the iambic capability. It sounds like that ICOM does, and probably, my guess is probably most of them, but not all of them do. So that really answers the question. But yeah, no, presently right now it's an older rig. It's just designed for a straight key. The only way I make it work as an iambic is because I hook up this external MFJ electronic key panel / it's all in one. It's really a key bolted on top of a paddles, dots and dashes on it, separate dots and dashes. So that's really the setup here, Dick. An old rig, but the question is dealing with the newer rig. And he already answered it.
Pretty fine, Paul. Good luck with that new purchase if you go for one. And that 440 is a very respected rig. I don't think you have to retire that, but that's your choice. The next person signed in was John with a very noisy signal. Hopefully some kind of a change has occurred. The band got a little bit better or whatever, John. So give me a brief transmission. Let's see if we're going to be able to copy you. Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel, November, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, this is KD2, BHN. Can you copy?
You seem to have a pretty good location right now, John, so go right ahead.
Yeah, so my question is, I have a 1.5-watt Yaesu HT, which is probably responsible for my poor signal, and I'm thinking about either upgrading to a 5-watt or a 7-watt HT, or maybe a base station, or building a better antenna like a J-pole. I've seen the plans on the Internet for the antenna wire, 300-ohm wire J-pole. And which do you think would be more effective, a new HT or a better antenna?
You've asked a very good question, John. I mean, yes, John, and I've got a strong opinion on this one. When you go from a 1.5-watt HT to a 5-watt HT, at first you say, gee, that's 3 1/2 times more power. Oh, boy, am I going to really have 3 times the range? Radio doesn't work that way. 3 times more power is 4.7 dB increase. That's 2/3 of an S unit on a well-calibrated S meter. It's something, but that 5-watt radio is going to drain the same size battery 3 1/2 times faster. If you build yourself a very simple antenna made out of coat hanger wire, and because of the way 2 meters operates, where altitude is everything, you take that coat hanger wire antenna and hang it with a thread from the ceiling of the second floor of your room, of your house, or put it on the chimney, you can easily make the signal 20 and more decibels stronger. 20 decibels, by the way, is a 100-to-1 ratio. You'd have to go to 150-watt output from that handy talkie to get the same performance with that rubber duck, if that's what you're using. So the simplest antenna made out of coat hanger wire hung on the chimney could easily be 20 dB stronger because of the extra altitude and the clearance of all the stuff in the house and all the other buildings nearby. So you're going to get a lot more bang for the dollar with just more altitude to the antenna. And the next step beyond that is to make the antenna, let me drop. Now you make the antenna have a little bit of gain to it. You make it a 3-element Yagi, a 5-element Yagi, a 7-element Yagi. And again, you can build that out of a long piece of dowel and coat hanger wire. The designs, you go to wa5vjb.com. You go to the website of www.WhiskeyAlpha5VictorJulietBravo. WhiskeyAlpha5VictorJulietBravo.com. He's a guy in Grand Prairie, Texas, near Dallas, that sells these printed circuit antennas. But you go to the right section of his website, he'll show you how to build a multi-element Yagi out of coat hanger wire. Very, very simple design. It'll cost you $3, if you know what I mean. The biggest price you will pay is for the Don connector you decide to put on it. and that can give you another 5-7 dB more gain, so that you could be 20 dB stronger because of altitude, 7 dB stronger because of the antenna's got some gain. You could be 27 dB stronger by taking that, let me pick a number, $2 Yagi and mounting it on the chimney of the house. So on 2 meters, antenna and location is everything. The number of watts you transmit is secondary. And that rig you've got right now sounds beautiful if you give it a reasonable set of antlers, if you know what I mean, John. As you can tell, I've got a very strong opinion as to where you're going to get the biggest bang for the dollar. And we're going to save you some money in the process. And you can send that to the tech net. That was a joke. KD2BHN, K2RIW. There, John.
Yes, thank you. That's very helpful. I mean, you know, I think I may both increase power and build a better antenna, but clearly the 1.5 watt VX3 with the rubber duct is not working. I mean, it hits the Glenn's repeater, but it's not really adequate in terms of signal. So I think I'm going to need to invest in both a better antenna and probably a better HD or a base station. Thank you very much. That was very helpful advice that you gave.
A6DP said with a comment.
How recognized. By way of the connector that allows you to disconnect the rubber duck, you can easily connect a piece of cable from there to this external antenna, so that when you're in the house, that 1.5 watt handy is going to be, you don't have to tell anybody you're running 1.5 watts. They'll assume you're running 5 watts, because most of the handy talkies are 5 watts. And the difference is only 4.5 dB, that's 2/3 of one S unit on a well-calibrated receiver. Whereas raising the antenna is going to put you 2 or 3 S units ahead of the game. So when you're at home, you plug into the antenna instead of the rubber duck. And when you're walking around the neighborhood, the rubber duck is very handy. I wouldn't change the rig, but that's me. Let's see what Hal would do. K6DPZ, wait for the 4 beeps, Hal. You almost never do. K2RIW in the TechNet.
My comment is, also use very low loss feed line. Don't go with feed line that has high loss, because you've only got 1.5 watts of power, and you want to get the most power up to that antenna so you can utilize the gain of the antenna. And I waited for the beep, 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 dick.
Yes, that time you did, Joe. I mean, Hal, but the 3 previous times you did not. You may have forgotten. In the heat of battle, we all, we're real fast on the key here sometimes. If you used RG58 cable, and if he's only using 20 feet of it, no sweat. If he's using 100 feet of it, where he's going to get on 2 meters of 5 dB of loss, that's subtracting some of the benefit. So worry about the insertion loss of the cable, and it's a good point that Hal's making. So you know how many feet of cable you're going to run. You go to the right reference curve or the right data sheet for the cable. It'll tell you decibels per 100 feet. And the nice thing about loss of cable is it's linear with length. If you're using a particular cable that says it's 10 decibels per 100 feet at your frequency, and you're only using 20 feet of it, 20 feet is 1/5 of 100 feet, 1/5 of 10 dB is 2 dB. So you would get 2 dB of loss with 20 feet and 10 dB of loss with 100 feet. In my example of cable, there's 100 dB, a correction, 10 dB per 100 feet. So it's a linear relationship in decibels, and you know exactly what you're going to get. But in my opinion, you're going to get a healthy 20 dB of improvement by just having the extra altitude of the simplest antenna in the world mounted on the chimney. And it doesn't have to be on the chimney. You'll get some of that benefit if it's hanging on the second floor of the house inside the, you know, hanging from the ceiling on a tack and a thread, so to speak, from the highest room you've got in the house, even in the attic. But outside, that does give you more benefit. In the attic, you're going to get some loss on a snowy, rainy day when the radio signal's got to go through all those wet shingles, if you know what I mean, and it suffers some extra loss. As you make that antenna improvement, John, I recommend you do the antenna first before you buy the handy-talkie.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As you make that antenna improvement, even if it's a simple coat hanger antenna that you build by going to that website I recommend, please come back and tell us what you've done, and we'll evaluate how much better you sound on the input, and we'll all cheer if you know what I mean. Is that a deal, John? KD2 BHN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that is a deal, and you know, I would expect to be in a position to make those changes within a week or two. Remarkably, Radio Shack doesn't sell home coverage.